So we're in this series, week 5. I think you saw it there. Week 6 is next week. Ray is going to preach in my stead, and thank him again for doing that. He's actually upstairs this morning helping our other pastor with BC 101. So, Ray, Youth Church. Okay, sorry. Renamed shortly or recently. We're getting to know our neighbors a bit. By being able to name them so they're not remaining strangers, and by getting to know them so that they might become friends. But in doing so, we can encounter what we might call real-life issues. And it's these that sometimes remind some of us why we don't actually get involved with our neighbors, because it can get sticky, it can get messy. It's why Jackie, for instance, cautioned me about going on our Strata Council, because I'd be handling complaints, and then I would be getting to know our neighbors on that basis, being one of the faces on the lane that's laying down the bylaws, right? No one likes that. You get vilified by being that person. It's messy. It's awkward. And she'd say, and we have to live here. Oh, we're going to move, right? At times, it can feel overwhelming to be in relationships. Rick first met his neighbor while they were both working on their lawns. Rick's wife had baked some cookies for Kurt and his wife. Nothing big, just a sort of contact point. They were nice enough people, were these neighbors. Rick had noticed that they had their share of difficulties in their relationship, but nothing huge. One evening, Kurt knocked on Rick's door and said he and his wife had been arguing. He asked if there was any way he could crash at their place for the night. Rick's heart went out to him, of course. He'd give him some help in this time of crisis. That first night on Rick's couch stretched into another night, and then another night, then a week, then 2 weeks. Rick and his wife, of course, felt stuck. At one point, realizing that this was going to be a little bit longer commitment than he had anticipated, Rick decided to give Kurt a key to his home so he could come and go as he needed. Rick and his wife kept telling each other, surely this is just like a rough patch in their marriage. Kurt's not bothering us. He's just using the couch in the basement. I mean, it's okay. It's good. And sure enough, things did seem to get better. And after about a month, Kurt and his wife patched things up. Kurt moved off their couch and went back home to his wife. 2 months later, however, Rick woke up in the middle of the night to hear a scratching sound downstairs. The front door creaked. I'll do my best creak. How was that? Pretty nice. The front door creaked, and then it closed quietly. He heard footsteps across the linoleum. Someone was in the house. Rick slowly walked downstairs with his golf club in hand. Hey, dude, came a familiar voice. I was trying not to wake you. We had another fight. If it's cool, I'll just crash on your couch for a few days. Kurt had let himself into the house with the key that Rick had given him earlier. This time, apparently, Kurt assumed he was welcome to stay. Rick mumbled something about talking about it in the morning, then stumbled back upstairs to bed. All he ever wanted was to be a good neighbor. But now he was smack dab in the middle of a marriage gone sideways. What do we make of Rick's situation? I mean, his heart seemed properly motivated. He reached out to someone in need. We would call that a neighbor, even if he isn't living next door. He helped how he could, but did he clearly communicate expectations? Did he talk about boundaries? And why? Why on earth would he not take his key back when Kurt got back with his wife? Did giving Kurt a place to stay help or hurt Kurt's marriage? Did it enable conflict avoidance, or was it just a good cooling off solution? Did it give Kurt a way out when he should have been staying in and dialoguing and persevering? And how did Kurt's wife feel about things? What effect did helping Kurt have on this neighbor's relationship, Rick's relationship with his wife? How could Rick have kept his neighbor's crisis from becoming his own? How could Rick have met the need of his neighbor without the dependency that it seemed to create? Or more generically, and here's the question for us as we engage our neighbors and love them the best way we can. How do we figure out what we will do and what we won't do for our neighbors? Because one of the biggest challenges of being a good neighbor is that your neighbors, as Jackie was saying, well, they're always there. If a problem arises, they're like just 10 meters from your door. When things get difficult, there's nowhere to run unless you plan to sell your house. So being a good neighbor can be scary, but it can also be exciting. I'm going to ask Josh to cue up a video here of a guy named Mark, and this is a bit of his story. So Mark's story about the trickiness of being a neighbor and the challenges.
One of our neighbors actually not too long ago got a dog that was just, it just was a barker. It just became a bigger and bigger issue, and in our house it would kind of bother us. We weren't really sure what to do about it. It would keep us up, and we kind of wrestled with what to do. We had made the decision not to contact the police if there was any way possible. We wanted to have that face-to-face, so we tried to knock on their door, etc. I ended up leaving them a note at one point. Of course, that never goes over well at all. That's a bad decision in pretty much any conflict, just leave a note. So anyway, made that mistake. Got on the phone with them finally. Didn't go well. In fact, it went really pretty bad. I had been defensive about my dog by the end of it. She had been defensive about her dog. We had decided, we'll just try to stay in communication about it. But it was definitely still some, I wasn't quite resolved. At one point, it snowed. Their car wasn't there. So I decided it'd be a good chance to just do something nice for them, just to let them know that, you know, it wasn't just the bad guy who was complaining about their dog. His aunt came out, and he was at the hospital being diagnosed, or had recently been diagnosed with cancer. There was no way I could really pursue this conflict about fixing the dog issue with this going on. I mean, I couldn't, if I put myself in their situation at all, it was just ridiculous to think I would put any effort into kind of maintaining my dog or containing it or whatever the issue was when, you know, this life-altering thing was going on. It just changed the conversation totally, right? The dog still barks. I mean, I don't think it's as often, but it's not as important. The next few months, we were able to really just kind of knock on their door and make ourselves available. We were able to help them with their yard a little bit last year. They're just really warm people that we've gotten to know. It's been great. We've been able to watch their kids for them. They've watched ours, and we've kind of developed that, and even having some spiritual conversations that you know, there's no way would have happened otherwise if we hadn't stepped out and tried to, you know, get to know them, just be good friends. You know, that's all it was. The relationships, I think, are, by nature, they just have a little bit of messiness to them, right? And I think if you're really wanting to love them the way that Christ told us to, you kind of have to be ready for that. Is this something we just want to do to check off of a list? Or is it something we really want to allow ourselves to be used by God?
Best part of that video, for me anyway, is when Mark said, the dog still barks. I don't think it's as often, but it's not as important. The thing is, I bet that dog does still bark as often as it did, unless it has an unnaturally high-functioning ability to conflict resolve. I suspect that God has just given him very situation-specific hearing loss and has changed his heart around that. It is exciting to be used of God to get to know people's stories, to join them in their stories as much as we might, and to become more Christ-like in the process. But it can also be very messy. So we may find at times that we'll need to step back and set some boundaries. In their book, Boundaries, Doctors Cloud and Townsend write, and I think this is going to be up in behind me so you can track the text with me. Boundaries define us. They define what is me and what is not me. A boundary shows me where I end and someone else begins, leading me to a sense of ownership, in a healthy way, by the way. Knowing what I am to own and take responsibility for gives me freedom. If I know where my yard begins and ends, I am free to do with it what I like. Taking responsibility for my life opens up many different options. However, if I do not own my life, my choices and options become very limited. We are victimized by the agenda of others, right? In other words, we need personal, relational boundaries between us and our neighbors to set in place what we are responsible for and what they are responsible for. We need boundaries to know our limits. We need boundaries to have the freedom to say yes to some things so that we can say no to other things, right? It might be helpful to think of a boundary as the difference between being responsible to a person and being responsible for a person. Now, we've talked about this concept, those prepositions, as it's related to parenting. I'm responsible to my children for certain things, not for. Being responsible for children, for instance, includes to love them, to encourage them, to bless them, to pray for them, to serve them, and certainly to forgive them. Those are all healthy. But being responsible for what our children do with our love and encouragement and blessing and prayers and service and forgiveness is their responsibility. There's a critical difference between responsibility to and responsibility for someone. We are responsible to love and bless and pray for people, but we are not, and please hear this, we are not responsible for outcomes or emotions or reactions of or someone else's choices. Those are theirs. It's the difference between, and I know you feel this because I feel this, because you have a heart, because you care for people. It's the difference between feeling like we have to have the solution for someone and helping that someone find a solution for him or herself. Here's another story. Kyle had built a strong relationship with a college-age kid in his neighborhood. A few years ago, this kid got high, got hungry, and went for a drive. He was busted for DUI and lost his license and his car. A year later, he got his license back, but he needed to get another car. His mom was a single parent, and money was pretty tight. So he approached his neighbor, Kyle, to ask for help. Kyle had an extra car, actually, as it turns out. Nothing special, but at least it was drivable. And he thought that God was challenging him to consider how he might help his neighbor. So you're Kyle. This kid has come to your door. What would you do if you were Kyle? Any thoughts? You could even turn towards each other for a minute and talk about it. This kid comes, asks, you have this car. What are you going to do with it? Yeah, take a minute. Turn to your neighbor. Take a minute, talk about it. And then just shout out some answers in a minute or so. Oh, I do like what I'm hearing. You know, I'm hearing a couple things. I won't tell you what I've heard because I want to hear what you said. So anybody want to just shout out from where they are what you might do in like in a sentence? Where do you, if you were Kyle and this kid came to you, you have his car, what might you do? Anything? Pardon me? Give the car to the mom, okay? Offer to drive him, okay? What? No, I'm not going to bother. No. I'm almost certain that was a Hollywood Squares answer, but anyway. And you're too young to even know what that reference means, right? Who knows what Hollywood Squares is? Put your hand up. Oh, okay, it's come back. All right, good. There's a throwaway answer. Paul Lynn, Center Square. Okay. Okay, so here's what happened. This is how the story went. He went to the boy's mother to ask her what she thought about the situation. She said all she wanted was for her son to get a job and stop getting high. But the major obstacle to his getting a job was transportation. Then Kyle sat down with the young man to see if he really wanted to change. And the young man said he did. And I think overheard here that maybe this is just a one-off and maybe this kid just needs a second chance. So Kyle sold the car to the young man's mother for half of its resale value. Rather than just giving the kid money or just giving the car, Kyle empowered the mom with a means of transportation so her son could work and begin to get back on his feet, but there was this accountability piece attached to it. Fortunately, the kid got his act together. But the outcome, as I said earlier about boundaries, was never Kyle's responsibility. The kid could have just as easily continued to smoke weed and lost his new job regardless of Kyle's car, right? This story illustrates a couple of boundary principles, and they're going to seem self-evident probably, but they're worth talking about a little bit, I think. First, take your time when you're considering these things. Take your time and get more info. Sometimes, like when Rick first knocked on Kurt's door, needs are time sensitive, and you're not rehearsing all the scenarios to know what you would do. You don't sit down with your friends. Well, what if Kurt came? Well, what if Kyle? What if you just don't know, right? Your heart's tuned to serving people, so your first impulse is to say, "Yeah, crash on the couch." But when we could take our time to figure out how we might help someone, I think we should take that time. Slowing things down, getting more information, talking to relevant and informed parties. I don't know how that works for you, but it tends to make my decisions a whole lot better. Kyle did both. He slowed it down, and he talked to the boy's mom, and he talked to the boy, right? Second thing, and this is even more obvious than the first one, but maybe it's not for us who feel guilty about not giving more, right? Give what you can, not what you can't. Kyle had a car to give, so he gave it. Though, as we said, he tied that responsibility piece to it and didn't just give it away. It probably goes without saying, but we can't give what we don't got, which is in itself a boundary. I can't help if I can't help. I can only offer what I can only offer. Can I get one more of those crazy statements? I cannot give what is beyond my resources to give. This is actually how we give as a church. Your leaders acting on your behalf and with your input and together as a church family when we do these things together. We don't worry about the what if we don't have any resources to give scenarios, because that question is already answered by this point. Then we don't give because we can't. Our giving conversations begin with this question: can we help? And we go from there to, should we help? Are we the best people to help? And then thirdly, if those two are answered in the affirmative, it is simply, how might we help? What is the best way that we could? And sometimes we can, and sometimes we can't. I think in lieu of time, I was going to share another story with you, but I won't. I'm going to share a gospel story with you instead. There's a story in the gospel that illustrates this boundary principle, giving what you can, when you can, how you might. It's the story of a man traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho. He gets attacked by thugs. He was robbed and beaten and left for dead on the road. Two folks passed him by on their way to church. Finally, a Samaritan stopped to help the man. He bandaged him up, loaded him on his donkey, and took him to an inn where he could recover. The Samaritan did what he could. But please, and this is where it's a different sort of lens on this story, please notice what the Samaritan didn't do. He didn't stay and help the man any further. He didn't bring the beaten man back home. And he didn't cancel his plans. He continued, in fact, his trip from this point in the story. Look, he did some incredible things, but he didn't do everything. The Good Samaritan was willing to adjust his schedule, but he didn't allow this event to change his entire life. How do you put it into perspective? As often happens, as preparing for teaching, a story comes along that synchronizes perfectly with the point being made. And such is the case this week. One of our members, who I'm not going to point out by name, only because they don't like to be embarrassed by these kinds of stories. But I'm going to tell the story because it's not really a story about this person. It's actually a story about his God. So, this person, let's call him Chad Dirksen. I just didn't know a way to work around that with all the pronouns. It was just going to kill me. I couldn't tell the story. So Chad was, I don't even know where. It was in Abbotsford, I think. And he was with his son, and he's in his car, and he sees a man coming down the road, and he's got this big gash in the middle of his forehead. He's bleeding, and he's stumbling, and it's looking pretty not safe. And so Chad does what I think we'd all do, and is consistent with the point we're making here, is take your time, slow it down, assess. So Chad sort of stayed in his car, observed, and then moved on a bit. At one point, he said to our God in sort of faith and dialoguing it through, and this would be like a Gideon-like fleece, if there's something I can do, Lord, just have him come my way. And sure enough, he came his way. Because that's how that happens, right? When you pray those prayers. So don't be surprised when that happens. So he comes to... It says to Logan, stay in the car, I got this. So he gets out of the car, and he goes over, and he does what he can. He gets information. He takes his time. He finds out that this guy, it's an infection, right? And no one had been willing to help him at this point. It's more likely that people were on their phone saying, there's some kind of weird creepo. You got to tag this guy because he's going to hurt somebody. He's walking around with blood gushing out of his head. It's over on, you know, whatever. So Chad said, well, you know, how can I help you? Well, I really need to get to, I think, St. Paul's or one of the hospitals. And Chad said, well, I'm not sure I can do that, but, you know, maybe something else. Well, what I really need, actually, is bandages. And Chad goes, bing, I can do that. Gets in the car, goes, grabs some bandages, and brings them back to this guy, right? This is what we mean. We're not asking you to turn your life over for your neighbor. And you'll want to focus your energy towards folks in your neighborhood who are going to receive the love that you would demonstrate, the service that you would bring, right? All Chad did was tune into what God was up to. And our God is always saying, hey, come here. I got this really cool idea. Here, come here. And looking for us just to be engaged in what he is doing. If we would just slow down enough to listen. Because it required Chad to change his schedule, but not to change his life, right? I think that illustrates the point here. Here's the deal. We can always give more time, more money, more energy. We could always do more. But there can come a time when it might not be A, good for us to do, or give more, B, good for the other person, or C, both. As we talked about last week, giving and giving and giving can become tiring and draining, especially if we're really lousy at self-care. And it can then create resentment, especially if our hearts aren't motivated by God to give. So, it may not be good for us in some situations to keep on giving. And it may not be good for the other. It's important for people to take responsibility for their solutions. It's a healthy part of growing up. Sometimes we just can't be a part of the solution because it would actually deprive that other person of their chance to come up with a solution to their problem, for them to take responsibility. Sometimes we have to ask, is my help actually helping, or is it creating a kind of dependency, or is it enabling something unhelpful, or is it perpetuating a problem? So here's the last boundary, put in positive terms. As often as possible, give hand-ups, not hand-outs. I think the best case scenarios are those when we are able to walk alongside our neighbors in need and help them find their way. It maintains their dignity and it keeps us humble because we are all in need at different times. Walking alongside someone, we can stay informed, give what we can, and love them, encourage them, and pray for them. Perhaps the hardest thing about this good neighboring stuff is that we can feel the pressure of doing or giving more, but we can't be everything to everyone. So I want to give you, and me actually, permission to stop making ourselves feel bad about not doing more, when that might be the very best thing that's needed. The challenge is realizing it's not about what we do, but why we do it and how we do it. At the end of the day, loving our neighbors needs to be an exercise in gratefulness for all that we have in Jesus Christ, in asking God what we might do in a given situation, like Chad did, and like these other stories illustrate, and asking him to make us wise so that our help is actually helpful. Good neighboring is about journeying with people who are open and responsive to our neighboring efforts. It's about getting to know them and their stories and simply giving what we can, when we can, how we can. Let's pray.